Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. I was just thinking, over my career, and I'm sure in yours, you faced all kinds of dilemmas and opinions, and this is the way we do it, I don't think people do it consciously, but I've run into people that just absolutely deny the facts that are presented in front of them. You know, this part melted, you know, kind of thing. No, that never happens, and stuff like that. Why does that happen? You know, have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I sure have. I remember early in my career, I was a supervisor in a test lab, and we ran into that in the one-off. You know, this part failed. Well, it's just an anomaly. Let's just run some more, and maybe that was only a one-time. Mm-hmm. And that type of thinking was almost always present. They trying to explain away what happened.
Well, it's easier to not have to think about it too hard. Just throw out a plausible theory, you know. Oh, that was a faulty prototype. It must have been their first stamping. Instead of saying, "Well, what's the root cause of this?" Because then you know it's going to take a week.
Yeah, and it's so dangerous because you could have a valid failure, and then if you ignore it, and then by chance, the rest of your samples pass, and then you ignore the failure as if it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then you have problems in the field. I mean, you get safety issues potentially. So it's a very flawed way of thinking. And every failure matters. So it's important to not discount any of them.
Well, the issue, though, is, Carl, is that you and I, and I think a lot of our listeners get that, is that if and when we have a failure as a prototype or anywhere, it's something to learn from. I think anybody that's listened to this podcast has heard us say this numerous times. Yet, I think there's plenty of pressure on our peers because they're not only dealing with prototype failures, they're also dealing with functionality and cost and time to market and, you know, design for the environment and design for supply chain and on and on and on. The amount of irons in the fire, to use that analogy, is a lot. There's a lot of things going on. And so if you come up to a design engineer or a team and say, "Oh, this doesn't look right," it is so much easier just to wave your hand and hope it goes away so that you don't add another burden onto your plate. I don't know if that's consciously done by many people, but it's a survival mechanism, I imagine.
I'm sure it is. So let's talk about a bigger picture here, which is, what is the character? How does character matter in an engineer? And of course, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Character matters a lot. And I remember this from the legal work that I've done. Mm-hmm. And because as a professional engineer, you have certain responsibilities that go beyond just the mathematics or the content of your job. And things like integrity, personal character, those things matter.
Yeah, things like conflict of interest and being upfront about those things serving your customer, your client, or serving others in society rather than yourself. Things like that all come to play.
They do. And I remember teaching early when I first picked up a reliability group years ago that as a reliability engineer, you have to be willing to take a stand that may be unpopular. And like there may be pressure to launch. But if you believe something is not right, you really have to speak up. And so we talked about the integrity of it and things like that. So there's a aspect of our job that is beyond just the numbers and beyond just the tasks and that type of thing, that involves integrating all of that into who are you, why are you there, and what's important, and are you willing to take a stand?
Well, yeah, I kind of look at it, I mean, in a similar way. I also look at it as what we're doing is it has to add value. You know, I look at it as somebody says, oh, you need to run this test. And like you worked in a test lab, you talked about a door latching test of some sort, the robot open and close this door a bunch of times. And it's one of those things to me is that it's one thing to do the task or write the report or, you know, collect the data and put it in a table and send it off someplace. And but there's also a bit more that we need to think about, that it needs to actually make a difference or be used appropriately or to get to the right people so they can consider it. And that's what I mean by adding value. And part of it is, as I agree with you, Carl, is that if, you know, if something doesn't look right, and something needs more investigation or something needs to be addressed, that, yeah, we need to stand and make that point of view known. But I think there's a broad issue of just, and it goes across all engineering, is that we got to do things that make sense. It, just because we've always tested 38 samples in this particular way doesn't mean that's the right thing to do. And I think that's just basic common sense. I keep coming back to this, that we and our peers have way too many things that we could or should be doing. And so prioritizing and focusing and doing things that add value is one way to cut through the clutter of that stuff. But the other part is that we have to stand back and say, does this even make sense? Why are we doing this? Why are we approaching this problem this way? Or why did it fail? Let's sort that out.
I completely agree. I mean, common sense it has to be at the forefront. It's almost like always present. Do the numbers make sense? Does it make sense, the results we're getting? It's like an X factor, because you can't put it into a formula.
No.
You know, the common sense formula. It has to be part of your character and experience integrated together, going, something doesn't seem right.
Yeah. I had a boss that used to call it the sniff test. You know, I bring him some analysis and he'd look at it. And if he started sniffling a little bit, you know, doing this kind of thing, then I knew that, I did something wrong, or this isn't going to add up here. He's going to find a flaw here. And he might not know exactly what it is yet. And, you know, when I was new as a manufacturing engineer and we're running experiments, he said, you know, I've been here 15 years. I've never seen results that look like that again. And then we go back and check our measurement system and going, oh, okay, the measurement system's way out of whack. It's just a random number generator. And we fix that. And he goes, now, see, this makes more sense. Now, I didn't have stacks of data to show you one way or the other. That's why I wanted you to do the analysis. But he had this kind of gut feel, or he called it a sniff test. You know, if it smells a little iffy, then we need to double check this.
One of the first ones I remember running into, and I'm going back to a long ways here to my first job as a reliability manager. When I picked up GM's one of GM's groups in 1989, and all they did is allocate reliability.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had 12 people at that time when I first picked it up. And that's all they did is do reliability predictions and allocate reliability. And they would come to me with their all proud about their reliability allocation to 4 decimal points.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of snickered, just like your boss did.
Yeah.
And how do you do it to 4 decimal points? And mathematically, they can show you how they did it to 4 decimal points,
right?
But it didn't make any sense.
No, they had one or two digit inputs at best.
Yes, exactly. At best. And so it at best, it was accurate to some level. And to me, that was common sense. I'm sure there's a way to frame it mathematically, you know, as to how do you know how many decimal points to go to? But that wasn't the point. It was my reaction.
Yeah.
It's one from a base of common sense.
Well, there's this idea that if you're, let's say you're just running an experiment, whatever it happens to be, and you are, our scientific training background says, well, you set up a hypothesis. What is it that you expect to happen? And what do you expect to not happen? And then set up your measurements appropriately. And it's basic common sense to me that if you don't do that and you don't make any measurements, you're just wasting energy, you know, just throw some samples in the oven. Okay. Why? What are we doing there for? Why? What? And yet, I bet you both of us and half our audience has got stuff in an oven and they're not really sure what they're doing with it in there.
Right. I've told this story of when we used to test every time there was a new door in that door test lab, we would requisition and get a fairly large sample size of door beams, door mm-hmm. impact beams that are inside the sheet metal. Mm-hmm. And we put them on a fixture and we would do force deflection curves to measure whether or not they met the right requirements, which included federal requirements. Mm-hmm. And then somehow somebody said, why are we doing that? We could calculate that so easily, knowing the material and the diameters and the geometry.
Right.
Why do we have to do this to a number of samples? And of course, the answer is we don't. We can use simulation and calculations and things. And we did that in parallel, and it proved out to be very good. But it took that common sense question.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Some people seem more born with it, but I keep coming back to why do we run into so many times? And I am guilty of it myself. I think one theory is that we're busy and it's a coping mechanism to deal with. I just don't need one more thing on the plate. And it's counterbalanced by, well, that failure, as you illustrated, Carl, may be critically valuable. And I keep thinking in my mind is I had 5 prototypes and one failed. And I've had people tell me that, well, it didn't fail for what you were looking for. Okay. How does that matter?
Yeah.
You know, it failed because the power supply blew up or fried or did something like that. But I was testing the CPU and yeah, I got a new power supply and kept on going. But if 20% of our power supplies don't work, that's a problem, guys. You know, you only had one failure. So it's 1 out of 5. Yeah, that's 20%. That's kind of common sense here. This is not a part per million problem that we know of. Our evidence is X. And I ran into it early also with electronics when I was working at Hewlett-Packard. Is we would get, 20, 30 prototype boards built early in the process. And they're usually done on a quick turn process. So we would send them the drawings. They would etch it overnight and print them. I mean, we get it the next day, but there was no error checking. There was no, if there was anything wrong in the design, it showed up. If there was anything goofy or variable in the process, it showed up. And so it was one of those things that was a balance between, is this just the shortcut we're taking to get them quicker? Or is this a real problem? And it was a constant struggle until we got a prototype and we made, 500 boards and 85% of them were bad because of an issue we saw earlier. It was a design issue. And they waved it away saying, oh, that was just an anomaly of the prototype process. And it's really hard not to say, I told you so in those circumstances.
Yeah.
I don't advise doing it. It's not a good thing to have happen. Yet it gives them a lot. It gives your team a lot of focus and you have a story now saying, hey, we need to pay attention to this stuff because the math doesn't lie. if 1 out of 5 is 20%.
Yeah. Well, let's take up something that you and I have talked about many times, which is failure mechanisms mm-hmm. that are so important in designs. So there are times when failure mechanisms matter, and there are times when you go beyond what's been called the foolish failure limit or things like that, mm-hmm. and you're into an entirely different realm that will never be seen. And there's a element of common sense somewhere that you have to be within a range of values and operating conditions that sort of makes sense. And so I was wondering if you had some thoughts on failure mechanisms, when you want to be aware of them, and at what point do they no longer make sense? Because frankly, everything will fail if you get it hot enough and put enough force on it.
Oh, yeah.
If you put your cell phone in the middle of the sun, it'll fail in about a millisecond. So there's common sense and there's common sense.
Well, the hard part is that it becomes a gray area real quick. And then each individual's sense of what's expected or common influences where they come down on a particular issue. So use just a soft polymer, for example, that if I run it up in a hot oven, say at 200°C, and it has a melting point of 140°C, well, I'm just going to get a little bit of liquid polymer coming out of the bottom of the box, right? And so if there's a phase change, and that's why we see so many tests set up from 0 to 100°C, because if there's any moisture at all, then we're phase changing that moisture. We're freezing it, which then expands and cracks all kinds of things apart. And we also steam it, and that creates a whole different level of failure mechanisms. But all materials that go through phases, you have to be conscious of that, is where are those phase changes occurring, and does your testing go across one of those? And a lot of people forget that in polymer, I pick out because it's unless you're very specific about what polymers are being used in your components or systems or other elements, you know, 140°C melting point is great for a consumer product that's used in the home, right? It's not so good if it's a lining on your furnace, right. And the burn on the inside of your oven, for example. The common sense part comes in a balance between where it's used and the amount of variability of those use conditions, plus the material set range of where their physical chemistry boundaries are for phase changes is the really the easiest first place to look. Now, I don't know of an engineer that I've ever talked to that didn't agree with that. All right.
Right.
Then the next day I walk in and I say, hey, we're doing halt on our product and our specification is 40°C and it failed at 45°C. Oh, you took it over the rate, you specced, blah, blah, nobody will ever see that. And then I open up the paper and show them Mumbai is at 50°C this afternoon. You know. Yes.
Yeah. Well, what you're describing, and this is kind of where I wanted, was hoping the conversation would go, is you're describing in that, you know, going past the melting point as a physical scientific discussion.
It's a fact. If you take this polymer to that temperature, it will melt. It'll phase change.
And it also makes sense. And that's kind of where I was going with this is sometimes things I think of as just common sense, but then if I think further, I can get the science that supports the common sense. Mm-hmm. And so I, as a practice, I don't want to just work on what makes sense or not makes sense to me because it could be wrong. If I say it doesn't make sense, like for instance, the reliability prediction to 4 decimals, I think I can go back and then find out what's the mathematical principle that supports the lack of common sense.
Right.
And so I think it's a combination of those things of instinctual, common sense based on your experience, but then being rigorous enough to at least reflect on what's the scientific principle behind it.
Yeah, exactly. The part of this process, though, to me is that part of it comes from experience. You know, if you're working with a material scientist, they have a different world of experience and understanding of how materials behave. And let's say we have an issue with creep. We've got some alignment issue and gravity is not our friend. And over time, even with the small masses we got, it creeps and we're out of alignment. For example, I'm thinking of a laser alignment set of mirrors that are used in some applications. And a very, very small change in the supports for those mirrors will have a dramatic effect on the alignment. And the problem is that we're not all material scientists. So that her common sense view of the world is different than my common sense view of the world. Mm-hmm. And nobody thinks like I do because I'm a statistician. So I think there are unusual, rare outliers like me that think about probability all the time.
Yeah. And you know, one other area it goes to, and I'm thinking of brainstorming here, because brainstorming is a very interactive activity, and you come up with all these crazy ideas, and one or two of them could be absolute gems. Mm-hmm. And then you apply the test in the brainstorming procedure of, does this make sense or not? Does it make sense to go forward with this idea?
Right.
So you have an idea to sell, you know, ice cubes to Eskimos or whatever, and does it make sense or not? And there's a common sense test applied to it that has to be backed up in some way, but oftentimes it isn't. Sometimes in the brainstorming sessions, we just go yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, to see whether or not we're going to consider those ideas. Mm-hmm. So I'm still a work in progress on this whole subject.
Yeah, well, in that particular case, I use multi-voting. Let's say we got 100 ideas up on the board and mm-hmm. got so many people, everybody gets, say, 8 votes and, you know, pick the ones that we want to move forward with. And that narrows it down pretty quickly. And then we don't even have the discussion about what, and if somebody is really passionate about the ice cube idea marketing plan for Eskimos, they can state their case and, you know, get out of the brainstorming mode and try to say, well, here's the full information of this. The common sense approach, I think, is always got to be, you got to ask questions. What are we doing this for? Is this add up? When we have failures, it's questions of, if you don't do root cause analysis, it's really hard to make a good judgment of it. You really have to pay attention to hand waving and dismissals and stuff like that. But I think at any time you set up an experiment, and I learned this in my physics classes way back in undergraduate school, was before you solve, you read the problem, guess at the answer. And we all looked at him like, what? And he's just guess, mm-hmm. you know? And for example, you have a ball rolling down a ramp and we're going to calculate how far it travels as it falls off the end of the ramp, some distance. And we can calculate that with basic physics formulas from Newtonian physics. And he said, but guess, just put a mark where you think it's going to happen. It's going to run 6 inches or it's going to run 60 inches or whatever your guess is. He says, but you're pretty sure that it's not just going to go straight across the air at escape velocity and take up an orbit around the Earth. You're pretty sure that it's not going to go up, you know, back up off right. against gravity. You have a pretty good idea what's going to happen here. So make a guess, do the calculations, check your answers. And, you know, somebody put in had an answer, they did the calculations and they came up with that it would go at -6 inches. It had minus sign in the answer, is the distance traveled. And he goes, now, does this make any sense whatsoever?
Yeah, that's a great story. And oftentimes that plus and minus sign can fit right into the common sense thing. In other words, you can steer away from ludicrous answers by using your own common sense indicator.
Yeah. Well, in our world, I think I told you about an analysis that was being done and it had a negative location parameter on a 3-part Weibull distribution. So they said that it's a failure-free period before you build the product. Well, it's just right. true. It can't fail until you build it, but times it hasn't even started having the opportunity to fail yet, which is, you know, kind of fits, but does this analysis make any sense here, guys?
No. Right. And I think I've told you the story of my first, in my bachelor engineering degree, the first course that I took where I'm doing the final exam and it's mm-hmm. a project where I'm having to build a gear for a cake mixer. And I get all the way done with it and I'm literally out of time. And my little plastic gear is 12 inches in diameter, and it didn't make any sense at all, but I ran out of time. And so that would be one where I needed to start with that parameter pretty quickly.
That's right. It's got to fit in here, and maybe it's going to be in the area of 1 inch kind of thing, but you missed an order of magnitude somewhere in there.
I think just to summarize, there's a common sense element to our work, and we should acknowledge it, and we should be willing to use it. But then support it with facts and data and logic and science as well. But I think both things can work well together because I don't want to ever lose that common sense element in my work.
Yeah, the sniff test for my former sniff boss. Test. Yep. Cool. Good summary, Carl. If you've got a good common sense story, you're listening to this and chuckling at some of our stories, if you've got a good one, let us know. I'd love to hear it, and it may spark a couple more discussions in this realm. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a comment page there or form and join the conversation. You can find Carl and I and the other hosts on our About pages at Ascendo Reliability and also on LinkedIn. And we really do, as we've always said, appreciate hearing from you, and we look forward to hearing from you. So with that, Carl, let's go check our email, see if anybody's commented yet.
Sounds great to me. Thanks.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.